Welcome to Mid-Century Modernism with Monique, your go-to podcast for all things architecture, design, and innovation within mid-century modernism. Join me on a journey through the golden age of design, where every episode brings you fresh inspiration for modern living and unlocks the secrets of this iconic and timeless style. What are we waiting for? Let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Mid-Century Modernism with Monique. I'm Monique Anton, your host, and I have with me today a very special person, a friend of mine, Chuck Henderson, who was for 4 years the president of the Frank Lloyd Wright Conservancy, and he was also the owner of the Walker House, the Frank Lloyd Wright design in Carmel. How are you, Chuck?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad you're here. We've been looking forward to this for a while. So of the 4 years that you were president, we're going to get into talking about the Frank Lloyd Wright Conservancy. What type of work did you do there, and how did you get involved in this wonderful world of Frank Lloyd Wright?
Well, I guess I got involved because, you know, my family owned a Frank Lloyd Wright house, and I was lucky enough to be the steward of that house for a good number of years. I started out going there as a kid, not really realizing what it was, and then as I grew older and started to appreciate it for what it was, and I took over the management of it from my dad. So, and I really, when I do these things, I sort of dig into it and I learn about the history. And so then, you know, okay, well, who's this Frank Lloyd Wright guy? And, you know, and how the house came to be and how the house was built and, you know, the unique aspects of it. And so I got pretty involved in the task of maintaining it. But then also, I felt it very important to have the house available and open for the public. So that made it necessary for me to study up a little bit more so I could talk about it with people that were there.
And that's so nice of you to open up the home. I remember when I first came to visit you, it was this amazing, almost like a boat ride experience sitting in the living room. That house was so magical. And just sitting right on the water. So the work that you did was so important. Can you share with us how you restored the house?
Well, so for those who may not know, and you can, I guess, Google Walker House Carmel and you'll see lots of pictures, but it's Frank Lloyd Wright's only house on the ocean. And so having a house that's actually on the water, it provides us unique challenges. You know, it's kind of like the Golden Gate Bridge. You always have to do something with it. So very soon after I started managing it, we had it's got a very famous set of stepped out windows around 270 degree angle around the living room that just faces into the water. And so that had carbon steel mullions. And we'd been working for a while just to keep those up and bondoing them and repainting them, and like the bridge, you know, constantly. And finally we had to, you know, take and replace all of the mullions. And so we did that with stainless steel, and so it made it much more resilient. But, you know, it's getting hit with salt water and salt spray all the time. So there's quite a bit of erosion and such with that.
Right.
I guess the other really major project we did was the ship's prow that goes out into the water. It was, you know, worn down over time, and the Carmel stone that was built out of was eroding and pretty much ready to fall off. So we had a big project where we replaced it all the way to the bottom where it affixes to the rock below. And we took it in 10-foot sections and went all the way around it. And then we also took down all the scaffolding every night and put it back up every day just because we really didn't want anybody climbing around. Because it's right on the beach, people out there.
Oh, you know, you'll always see a crowd standing around it, always.
Yeah, so those are a couple of the big projects we did. We, you know, I also it had grown, a lot of the trees really grown over the top of it, so we opened it back up and redid the garden and this sort of stuff. But, you know, that is a very visible house, and that got the attention also of some of the other Wright aficionados, and some of those people were involved in the Frank Lloyd Wright Building Conservancy, kind of going back to your original question there. And they, you know, reached out to me to become part of the organization. And at first I was like, no, I'm just doing my house, you know.
I had my
head down just getting this stuff done. And Larry Wooden, one of the very active people there, you know, was constantly after me. But eventually I got a call from Linda Wagner, who was at the time the curator of Falling Water. And she was asking me to join. And I'm like, the curator of Falling Water is calling me up and wanting me to do this? So I'm really not going to say no to her.
Right.
And so I said, you know, okay. And I joined. My first conference with them was in Scottsdale at the hotel down there, which the name's escaping me right now. But anyway, the Frank Lloyd Wright, he was involved. He was in partnership with someone else that built that. But it was kind of interesting. I became a member of the Conservancy and a member of the board at the same time. So that was, you know.
It was great.
10 years or so ago. That's how I got involved with it.
Yes, and your work around preservation, you had mentioned you saved a couple properties and you were involved with that. What was that work like? What are homeowners, what would you advise homeowners to do when they become new owners of a Frank Lloyd Wright property? How would you advise them?
Get to know what you have. Understand where it fits within Wright's canon of work. Wright homes are not easy to maintain. They are certainly works of art. They're certainly all historic. They may represent, you know, a good model of one of his phases of work or one of the periods of his life. So get to know that. And get to know also the community of Wright owners that are out there and other resources that you have. The Building Conservancy is really a great collection of very knowledgeable homeowners, people who are willing to share what they have done, and the Conservancy itself has excellent technical resources. John Waters is a tremendous resource that can help with questions that you're going to have with maintaining and dealing with some of the other issues.
Yeah, John is basically an encyclopedia of Frank Lloyd Wright properties.
Yeah, he's the preservation programs manager there, and he's a godsend.
Yes, he is. Well, for those of you listening, you can go on to saveright.org, and there are so many resources available to you. There's even a section where you can see virtual tours. They have videos. I love this group because they've done videos of not only the homes, but of Taliesin West. They even have a video tour tomorrow. You all will listen to this later, but I'm sure you can find it in the archives. Tomorrow they have a historical Park Inn Hotel virtual tour, and that was the only hotel that Wright ever completed that is still in operation. They will be showing that, so I highly recommend going on to their website, not only joining and not only donating on the site.
Do that.
But to watch all of this richness, it's really inspiring. So you have been to both Taliesin and Taliesin West. I wanted to hear about your experience there.
So I'll tell you about that. So Wright's two main homes, Taliesin and Spring Green, and then Taliesin West in Scottsdale. He built Taliesin when he'd come back from Germany with Mamie Chaney, and kind of really wanted to have his own house back in the area where he grew up, right? This was where he you know, he was born to his father was a preacher, and his mother was a member of the Lloyd Jones family, some very God-fearing folks, and they had settled in that Spring Green area, and so he would spend a lot of time, a lot of his summers, with the Lloyd Joneses in that area, and it's really developed a lot of his work habits. And the statement saying that he would have is, you know, you just put tired upon tired, you just keep working, just keep working, and a lot of his perseverance and so on, and his love of nature, because he was outdoors doing a lot of that work. And so he went back home to that area and built his house there. And as typical with Frank Lloyd Wright, you never put it at the top of the hill, you always put it kind of a little bit, you know, so it, you know, organic architecture blending into the surroundings, you know, becoming part of the area, not dominating it, sort of fitting in. And he, you know, built a wonderful place there, but also built his studio. And then that evolved into having various apprentices that would come and work there, but also manage the farm, do cooking and, you know, maintenance on the place and other things. They built a school there, the Hillside Homeschool, where his aunts ended up teaching, you know, a lot of local kids and so on. That eventually became part of his studios as well. It's a wonderful place. It has, you know, a windmill up there with a Tanna Dairy, which was the house that the aunts lived in, and so on. It's a wonderful place to visit. It's had its tragic histories. It's had a number of fires. It's had some other tragedies that have happened there. Frank Lloyd Wright didn't lead a conventional life. He had lots of ups and downs throughout his life, and you know, that really also kind of helped form who he was. So Taliesin is the first one, and it's kind of the main mothership there. But then he got some projects down in the, you know, he was building things in Los Angeles, and then he got some projects in the desert, and he really kind of came to like that area as well. He developed some desert camp concepts, but then eventually built a wintertime residence down there, which was called Taliesin West. And again, the apprentices and everybody, they kind of all came down, they all built it, and they all kind of lived together there as a big commune. And it has a beautiful view out over the whole Scottsdale Valley. And there's a story of him having absolute apoplectic fits when the power company put some pole wires across the view of that. You know, did not approve of that whatsoever. But, you know, and then every year they would drive back and forth between those two places. And, of course, he would have his Cherokee red cars. He loved cars and convertibles and what have you. And they'd all drive between the two Taliesins. Back and forth. So, you know, and they're both very unique to the sites that they are in. So desert, and it's a wonderful place. You get to really experience Wright and who he was, how he lived in both of the two places, which were, you know, which are quite different, but also, you know, very similar in that, you know, Wright's design is all over them.
I have a friend who went in to study at Taliesin West recently, and she said they were stopping the tours for a little bit, but I think they're back on the tours.
I think they are. You know, I'm not up to date on all the inner workings of what goes on at Taliesin right now. I do know that they've got a gal down there, Jennifer Gray, who is, you know, putting together more of a broader-based education program. They used to have... Well, after Wright passed and the apprentices weren't so much apprentices anymore because Wright wasn't there, they formed the Taliesin School, so more of a formalized school, you know, unique in its own way, and then Taliesin Associated Architects, and was down there for a long time. More recently, the Taliesin Associates were moved out of Taliesin itself. And but they're with Jennifer, they're looking at, you know, how to extend that education mm-hmm. capability, but there at the school.
What was the most memorable moment you had working with these homeowners and your work at the Conservancy? No, there are many. many.
Well, you know, I guess some of the ones I would point to all really have to do with, you know, advocacy issues, because that's really, you know, the main role of the Conservancy is to advocate for the preservation of rights built work. And very soon after I became, I think I was president then, or maybe I was just about to be, but anyway, it was actually a really tragedy, though, which was the destruction of the Lockridge medical clinic in Montana. I think it was Whitefish. And we had a whole deal set there for someone to buy it and to preserve it, but it wasn't going fast enough for the owner, developer who owned it. And in, you know, he made a demand that we buy it right now or within a certain very short length of time. And then in the middle of the night, he brought in the bulldozers and tore it down. And so, you know, that was a very traumatic, because we had it all set. But then, since then, you know, we had a number of great positive ones. The Bagley House in Chicago, outside of Chicago, was a house made one of his original designs very early in his career, 1800s sometime. And that was going on the market in the middle of a very well-to-do area. Mm-hmm. And there was even some preliminary secretive plans being worked with the city or the local township there to, you know, buy this developer who was intending just to knock it down because, you know, it's a pretty old house, needs a lot of work in an area of a lot of big houses, a lot of big
McMansions.
Yeah, very modernish, you know, expensive. And so we, you know, raised a hue and cry about it because it was a very famous house, and the poor town got a lot more attention than they really had planned on, and in the press and all the rest of this. And then luckily for us, a guardian angel came in and bought it, Savina and Lucas Uberoy. And they already own a Frank Lloyd Wright house. They had a Tompkins house outside of Cincinnati, but they really wanted to do this. And so they have since restored it and added what we would find over here is an ADU to kind of make it more livable for a modern family and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But that was a nice save. Another one that the Conservancy worked really hard on, and it was really difficult for a while, but ended up in a positive way, which was the Booth Cottage, which was it was a temporary house that ended up staying for a long time. Mm-hmm. A very small, you know, house that was also targeted for development in a well-to-do area. And the Conservancy worked with number of the other preservation organizations in Chicago and ended up getting the developer to agree to donate the house. And we took it up off the property and moved it to another area in Glencoe, the same where it was. And it's now a public gathering place and museum and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So we don't really like to move houses. We did another one with Lindholm and had to do that because it was, anyway, so these, they all have a variety of unique aspects to them. And so that was another one. And so all of these various different ones were really the highlights. We had some great conferences. We, like I was saying, we really broadened the reach with all of the online programming. We did a lot of great stuff.
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. What would you say, what does it mean to you, these Frank Lloyd Wright homes and your work to keep them alive? What has it meant to you over the years? Two questions, I guess. What has it meant to you, and what is your experience in these Frank Lloyd Wright homes?
Well, you know, having had the pleasure of owning and caring for one myself, you get a sense of affinity with these buildings and their homeowners and the stewards that are looking after them. Mm-hmm. You know what they're doing and they're going through and what have you. So it's gratifying to be able to help others manage their properties and preserve them and educate them on, you know, how to do a National Historic Register, what are some of the options for preserving your house with easements and preparing it for the journey when you're not there, kind of thing. So that's always, you know, very gratifying. What it's like to visit other houses, you always see different things that are similar in how Wright approached things, but also quite different over the time that he had, the various different phases of his careers, and the types. You know, the American system-built houses are, you know, a completely different genre than the Usonians,
right,
and the
Prairie
School
house,
ones,
right,
and the earlier arts and crafts style and that sort of stuff. Like, so, but one of the things you do when you go into Frank Lloyd Wright House, and hopefully they'll let you do this, most homeowners will, and that is sit down in the living room. And Wright designed these places to be viewed while you're sitting in the living room or at the dining table or what have you, and take it in. Just sit there and just sort of feel the house around you and the sight lines and the views and what he was trying to gather and show you. And that's probably the most important thing that way.
That's beautiful. Do you have a favorite Frank Lloyd Wright design? Do you have a home that's your favorite
besides my former house? I don't know. There are so many different, you know, from the really famous, like, you know, Falling Water. We didn't talk about the home and studio, which is, you know, his original workhouse and family house in Chicago area. But, you know, there are, and here in the Bay Area, you have the Hanna House, which is really, really a nice one. You have the Bueller House. You've got Matthews House. So there are lots of different, those are all, all Usonians, except the Hanna House is a little earlier than Usonian. It's octagonal. It's really kind of unique. Mm-hmm. But they're all really different. Mm-hmm. The other thing I think I want to mention here is, as another great accomplishment that happened, had nothing really to do with me except I was there at the time, and that was the World Heritage listing, which Linda Wagner, I mentioned her earlier, and many others were very instrumental in, Neil Levine, in creating it, doing all of the write-ups, working with the Park Service, and eventually getting, I think it was 8 Wright sites listed on as a World Heritage site. So Hollyhock, Falling Water, Guggenheim, Little Jacob's House, which is a really tiny little first Usonian that was there, Roby House, Taliesin's, and I'm sure I'm missing someone. But it's, so now you can say that Frank Lloyd Wright, his work is a World Heritage Site, like the pyramids in Egypt and like the great temple in India, Taj Mahal, and, you know, so many others. So his place is ensconced now with the world's greats.
I'm going to take a moment for that. That's really powerful. Well, I cannot thank you enough for your work and the care that you've given homeowners and the help that you've given so many people over all these years. And I'd like to thank people for their work as well at saveright.org and hope that all of the listeners here will log on and contribute.
Yeah, and it's a great organization. They got a lot of great stuff, and they get you into Wright houses that you may never, ever otherwise be able to do.
What are some other resources that are available to homeowners through the Conservancy?
Well, I mentioned a little bit earlier about the technical resources with John Waters and such. There's a lot of educational resources on there as well to learn more about Wright. And there's a tremendous advocacy organization. And Barbara Gordon, the executive director there, manages this whole thing so well and so efficiently. And she's a tremendous advocate. She's built so many great relationships with so many different preservation organizations, both in Chicago and elsewhere. So she's a real advocate. And for homeowners and also, you know, the public sites folks, there's a lot of little house museums and that sort of stuff that really, you know, they don't have the resources of a Falling Water, but they get to learn from and get resources from the Conservancy and the other public sites. In fact, the Conservancy hosts every 2 years a conference kind of thing that's held in Wingspread, which is in the Johnson Wax homestead there, for these smaller home nonprofits, and so that they can learn how to better manage their properties, raise funds, provide educational programs, you know, all these kinds of things. So that's another tremendous resource that's out there for people that own houses and are running their own little private houses as well.
That's right. Well, thank you so much, Chuck. It's been an honor talking with you.
And likewise, thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. I hope you had as much fun learning about the world of mid-century modernism as I did. You can also catch the show on my YouTube channel, where we walk through some of the most stylish mid-century modern homes in California. Just search for Mid-Century Modernism with Monique and hit subscribe. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave me a comment to let me know what you think. Your feedback helps me make the show even better. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time on Mid-Century Modernism with Monique.